This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we tell stories about everything here on this show, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. They're some of our favorites. Today, we bring you the story of the Bolander family. They're from Kansas City and have a rather large family. Here's Faith with the story.
Randy and Kelsey Bolander have 10 kids, ranging from the age of 27 years old to 5 years old.
Jackson, Grayson, Zion, Zoe, Anna, Mercy, Piper, Creed, Cadence, and Scout.
6 of the Bolander children are adopted, and their adoption stories have been nothing close to boring. When they adopted their first daughter, Zoe, they barely made it home from the hospital.
We could only get within about 3 or 4 hours of her. We couldn't get right there overnight. So we flew till late into the night, drove most of the night, and at 8 o'clock the next morning, we were in her hospital room. We were still in Las Vegas, where she was born. And due to some paperwork snafus, we had to stay in Las Vegas for about 10 days. There we were, holed up in a little extended stay hotel. And the social worker called me at the hotel. "We don't have your fingerprints." And I said, "Well, we filed the paperwork." And she said, "Well, we don't have the fingerprints. Maybe you should call the FBI. And so I literally, it was like 1-800-FBI. It was just a general phone number, and left a voicemail. Oddly, they called me back and they said, "We don't seem to have it. I don't know that we've ever had it. I don't know what to tell you." I call my social worker back. I explain that the FBI doesn't know what we're talking about, which is never a good sign. And she suggested that maybe we should get an apartment because we may be there for a while. I just went into a panic. I'm like, I don't want an apartment in Las Vegas. I've got a home in Kansas City that I really like to go to. And she called us in about an hour and a half and said, "You know what? We found them. We have your fingerprints. They're right here. You are free to go." I hung up the phone and I looked at my wife and I said, "Shut the phones off. I don't know if she's right or not, but we are leaving. We're going back to Kansas City." So we raced to the airport, barely in time for a 5 o'clock flight. There's a 7 o'clock flight. We would like dinner. So we opt for the 7. We sit down, we have dinner, we go get in line and we sit and we wait. 7 becomes 8, 8 becomes 9. The plane gets pushed back to 10 o'clock. By now I'm exhausted. I'm a little bit panicky and I'm thinking that I might be a fugitive. And I'm sitting there holding this little girl, and I've read just enough John Grisham novels to know how this all works out. And so I'm looking around trying to figure out who is the FBI person here who thinks I'm leaving without my fingerprints. The plane didn't leave till 2 a.m. We landed in Kansas City as the sun came up. And again, just a wave of emotion. I realized, wow, we did it. We made it. We're home and we have a little girl.
A few years later, they adopted their twin daughters, Anna and Mercy. Before bringing the girls home, Randy had a very honest conversation with their birth mother.
She said, "I want to know how you feel about multiracial kids." She was Japanese Thai. And I said, "Well, I have a multiracial daughter at home. Zoe is African-American Latino. We are Caucasian. And I did not ask what race you were when I got on the plane. This is not an issue to us." With that, we walked down the hall. She checked out these twin girls out of the nursery. Little tiny babies, didn't even have names. Baby A and baby B. We looked around and there was a closet open, like a supply closet. We went into the supply closet and this lady did the bravest thing I've ever seen in my life. She kissed each one of them on the head and said, "This is your new mommy and daddy," and handed Kelsey and I each a little girl and said, "I need to go back to my room now," and turned around and walked out. I had to drive across the street to Target and buy car seats because we left Kansas City with nothing. And I'm in the parking lot taking car seats out of boxes and people are walking by staring at me thinking, that is the most lackadaisical, lazy man in the world that he didn't do this before. And I want to, you know, try and confront him and say, I didn't know, but that even made me look dumber. So I just ignored him. We stayed in Florida for another week in the area while they finished up paperwork and social workers met with the birth mom just to make sure this was something she was fully on board with. And then we turned around and flew back to Kansas City with twin girls. We were home 6 weeks with the newborns, with Anna and Mercy. And my wife motioned me to come down the hall. I went down the hall, we stepped into the bathroom and she handed me a pregnancy test and screamed into a towel. And so we went from 4 to 7 really quickly. 3 years after Piper was born, I get a phone call and it is Anna and Mercy's Berth's mom's sister. And I'm in my office, and she said, we had lost track of their Berth mom. She'd been homeless for a while, but I just got a call. She had been living in a U-Haul storage unit. And when they told her she had to leave, she said, I don't know if this is true or not, but she told the manager of the storage unit that she's pregnant with twins. I went from surely not to what are you going to do with the twins in about 30 seconds. In my mind, I saw my twin girls that I had at home that were their siblings. But in my mind, they weren't 2 or 3 years old or however they were. They were 15. And in my mind, they were asking, there were more like us and you didn't want them? And I just couldn't, bear that thought, that they would ever think that we would not want more like them. We flew down, met with her, said, you know, if you would like to keep your children together, we will willingly do this. It was a little, you know, it was a little bumpy, but she agreed. Not long after that, we brought home a little boy and a little girl, Creed and Cadence. 3 years after Creed and Cadence were born, late one night, my phone rings and I recognize the number. It is the lawyer that we used for Creed and Cadence's adoption. And I answer the phone and he said, are you sitting down? And I, you know, kind of instantly knew where this was going. He said, we just found out that the two sets of twins, Berth mom, had a little boy in the last couple of days. And he has been taken into state custody, but somebody at the hospital remembered that you had adopted the other four. And they called me and they wanted you to know.
And you're listening to Randy Bolander tell the story of his, well, large family and how it came to be. And it's not like typical large families come to be. 10 kids, 6 adopted. And when we come back, we're going to hear more from this remarkable family, the Bolander family, here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we return to Our American Stories and to Randy and Kelsey Bolander's story. The Bolanders have 10 kids, 6 of which are adopted, and 5 of their adopted children are siblings. We left off with the Bolanders about to adopt the 5th boy of that sibling group. He had just been taken into state custody. Let's return to Randy.
Lawyer called me and said, you guys need to come down here. We are going to remove him from state custody. And so that's what we did. We flew down and served papers on the state, which was a real turn of the tables. They're not accustomed to that. And about a week later, we flew home with Scout. And Scout was about 3 months old. You know, there's a law of diminishing crazy. The amount of chaos that one child introduces to a home is not multiplied by the number of children in the home. Just the nature that there are children in the home means crazy is going to happen. And so it's not like 10 are twice as crazy as 5. We joke about nothing working for our family. Nothing normal works. Normal house, normal car, nothing works. When we were all together under one roof, about the only thing that would work was a Ford 15-passenger E350 Super Duty homeschooler special van, big white van. I'm on my second. I've got 180,000 miles on the second one. It's the only thing that would work for all of us to go together. When we do go someplace, of course, people wonder. And I've kind of got a standing rule. When I notice somebody is watching and counting heads, as I walk by, I whisper, there's more at home, just to keep them wondering.
Even the cheapest of options for a family of 10 isn't very cheap.
At a fast food restaurant, especially with them getting a little bit bigger, if we just take the 7 or 8 that are usually with us now, you're going to drop with mom and dad eating 65, 70 bucks. you know, pizza is a three-digit affair. I had a friend one time, we were all at Chick-fil-A, their family and our family. And he was watching me and he asked me, when was the last time you sat down and ate a sandwich? And I couldn't really remember, because when you go into one of those places, you're always kind of on duty. You're standing, opening the sauce, walking from this table to that table. And so, you know, I can stand in my own kitchen and eat a sandwich.
With so many children at home, being relationally intentional with all of them is no small task.
There aren't enough hours in the day to go spend an hour with each child every day. It's just the math, it doesn't work. That said, one of the things that we have talked about from the time they were little was trying to figure out what is the key to their heart. What makes that child come alive, and how can we incorporate that into our day, whether we're as a group or we are one-on-one once in a while. It isn't as much about quality time together, it's about being known. And when they feel like they're known, it doesn't matter if they're in a group of five. They feel individually known by a mom and a dad.
The Bolanders are passionate about ministry and adoption as a ministry in particular. In order to build on that, they founded Zoe's House, an adoption agency to help make the process a little easier for people.
We have had a lot of talks about under what circumstances would we do this again. And one of the things that we've realized is we're not the only ones in the world that can do this, and we can help other people do it. And so we have taken steps towards how can we be the most productive in reproducing what we do rather than doing it all by ourselves. We had struggled with how adoption works and how it's done. Like any industry, there are people of widely different abilities and intentions. And we thought it was one of those things in particular that should be done right. We were very fortunate. The people that we worked with were very ethical, were very kind, did a good job. But you start hearing stories and you realize that sometimes it's not done that way. Knowing that we were now kind of the adoption people. When you have 10 kids, it's the only thing anybody ever remembers about you. We knew we would be fielding these questions for the rest of our lives and knew that we would love to make a difference in how adoption is done. And so about 5 years ago, literally within a couple of days of finding out about Scout, someone approached us and said, would you ever consider starting an adoption agency that might be able to do this and make it a little more doable for people and do a better job? And Kelsey and I have a long-running joke when one of us wants to do something, if it's something we're not qualified to do or we just haven't really been trained in, our joke is, has anybody dumber than us ever done this? You can almost always find someone. And so if we find one person who's dumber than us, we say, well, we can do that. They did it. And so we dove into it and we hired very smart people and they helped us considerably. We learned a lot and launched this adoption agency that has leaned into the idea of excellent birth mother care and also very above the board, honest dealings with adoptive families and just trying to make it the best experience that we can so that when it's done, adoptive families can talk about it with their children and not have a sense of shame and talk with honor towards their birth parents, which they deserve.
It's easy to look at a family like the Bolanders and be intimidated and not know how to go about having a family of 10, six of which are adopted. But how the Bolanders ended up where they are now wasn't a step-by-step plan they set out on.
You know, how in the world could you have four and have adopt another six? We get asked that a lot. Well, it didn't happen in one day. And yet people do that. You know, people adopt sibling groups. That wasn't our case. Who would say yes to 10? We would just say yes to the next one. Can you do this one more time? Very rarely does anybody say yes to 10 at one time. Very rarely does anybody ever get asked that question. But can you do one more? We found we had the capacity. We could do it. Now, there have been people who have kind of wondered, are you guys, you know, kind of hooked on doing a good thing? And they forget the fact that of the last five, they were all biologically related. And so it wasn't like we were cherry picking children from around the world to complete a set. We were, for those last five, fighting tooth and nail to keep a family of kids together. when you see other people that have done things that seem monumentous or a little out there, like adopting multiple kids or launching a business that went hugely successful or whatever, don't assume that they've got it any more together or any more talented than you are. They just said yes to an opportunity and they're figuring it out as they go along. People a lot of times will say, wow, you guys have great systems. You must have great systems to make life work. Well, no, actually our laundry room, it's chaos. Like we don't have any great systems. We just do life like everybody else, just at a larger scale. And so I think I've learned that those who I've looked at and gone, wow, they've done things I didn't know that I could do. Maybe I could do them if the door opened. The other thing would be not to wait until you have things all figured out until you try and do some good. Problem solving is a great skill, but you can't solve problems if you don't know what they are. And so to dive into them and to figure out what the next problem is and how I can fix it, you find yourself, 20, 30 years down the road, having done things you would have never thought you could have done or said yes to. One of the things I am proudest of in life is how my older boys have leaned into adoption. We're in ministry. The pie is only so big. And every time we have adopted, the slice of the pie would seem to get a little smaller for everyone. When we brought home twins, they fought their way to the front of the crowd in the foyer of the house to be the first ones to hold the twins. And it was one of the most gratifying things as a father that I've ever experienced. The value and the joy and the fun and the personality that the adopted ones have brought to the table, I think has so overwhelmed any sense of what might have been in a different world that the older ones just can't imagine life not having been like that. And they grew up in a house where there was always something going on. Fun was kind of a byproduct of the house and still is. It's a very fun, very loud, crazy place. It's been chaotic, but it's not been boring.
And a great job as always by Faith. And a special thanks to Randy and Kelsey Bolander for sharing their story, their family's story. Oh, and by the way, you can find out more about the Bolander's mission at zoeshouseadoptions.com. And a special thanks to our friend in Kansas City, E.J. Becker, for bringing us this story. The Bolander family story, a real beauty here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. That's OurAmericanStories.com. They're some of our favorites. Known as Canada's hockey dad, Walter Gretzky died at the age of 82. His death prompted an avalanche of tributes for an approachable, authentic person who nurtured the unsurpassed hockey talents of his son, Wayne Gretzky, on the family's famed backyard rink in Brantford, Ontario. Walter suffered a serious brain aneurysm which robbed him of much of his memory in 2007. That includes many of Wayne's biggest moments. The 60-year-old NHL legend-turned-American citizen delivered remarks at the St. Mark's Anglican Church in Brantford shortly after laying his father to rest. Wayne stepped up to the podium in front of family seated in the pews and reminisced about his father's life. Here's Wayne Gretzky.
Thank you. And obviously with the pandemic that we've had, it's been horrible for everyone throughout the world, in Canada, North America. I really wanted to tell everyone that my dad and my sister and our family were so conscious of it that COVID had nothing to do with the passing of my father. Unfortunately, a few weeks ago, he sustained a bad hip injury. And as he just said earlier, we thought weeks ago that the end was here. He has tremendous amount of faith like I've never seen, but he had a love for life and he didn't want to leave. And we were 21 days sitting with him and just enjoying life. And we got a chance and an opportunity to tell stories. Our grandchildren have never seen my dad after his brain aneurysm. And we were telling them all, you're thankful that you didn't know him before his brain aneurysm because he was a lot tougher. So it's been a tough time. I want to thank everyone in the community who dropped off food, who dropped off sandwiches. They knew we were all there for 21 days. My sister was a champ. She was beside him each and every minute of the day. The grandkids were wonderful. My dad and mom, I know, are so proud. So I thought I would tell a couple stories. I didn't know. I spent the last four nights talking with my wife, Janet, thinking what I was going to say. And like I usually do, I try to just kind of wing it and speak from my heart. So years ago, as everyone knows, my dad was such a huge sports fan and hockey guy. And we were playing in a hockey tournament outside of Toronto. And my dad was so proud of the fact we were going to play against better teams than little towns in this area. And on a Friday night, we were going to the tournament. And my mom said to him, Walter, we're going to have this baby this weekend. And he said, it's okay, you can wait till we get back. So, Brant was born on the Saturday. We went to this tournament in Whitby, Ontario. We played against good teams like Burlington, Oshawa, Hamilton, Toronto, Marlies, Nationals. We won the tournament. We got in the car, and we weren't sure if the car could get us back from Oshawa to Brantford. So we finally got back, and the next day, Mom came home with Brant. People were coming by, families, friends, sisters, congratulations on the baby, and every single person would say to my dad, Walter, I can't believe you missed the birth of your son. So our next door neighbor, Mary Rosetto, came over. She was the last person to come over. She said, Walter, I can't believe you missed the birth of Brant. And when she walked out the door, he was so mad, he stood up and he grabbed the trophy and he goes, yes, but we got the trophy. So as time goes on, he was so nice to all the grandchildren. Every grandchild loved him, close to each and every one of them. They understood how important he was, not only to our family, but to the culture of Canada. He came here, his family is an immigrant. They came here because they wanted a better life. I don't think I've ever met a prouder Canadian than my dad. And all my five children are American, born in the United States. And I always tell them, you should be as proud of the United States as your grandfather is of Canada, because that's how much he loves the country. So I always tell my kids, you know, there's nothing better in life than family. So my dad would come every year to our summer house, my son Ty, Trevor, Tristan. They had a hockey school, and dad would come out. He'd go to the rink, sign autographs like he always does. And we were playing golf one day, and he's picking up golf balls. And I'm like, we have all these golf balls. What are all these golf balls for? And finally, the next day, Ty, Trevor, and Tristan, my friend Mike and Tom, they're in the fairway, they're in the rough, they're grabbing all these balls. And I finally grab them. I said, you guys got to stop grabbing golf balls. They're like, what do you mean? Your dad wants them for the kids. I said, I know he wants them for the kids, but I got to sign them for the kids. So I take my dad to the airport at 5 a.m. Sure enough, we get to the airport, and there's this two big bags. And my brother Glenn, he runs out of the car. He's going to get a cup of coffee. And my dad goes, you'll sign these for the kids, right? I'm like, oh my God. So there I was signing for hours. But that's how he was. He was a remarkable man who loved life, loved family. We'd be a way better world if there were so many more people like my dad. Very special. We're all hurting. This is a tough time. I'm so proud of the fact that so many people have reached out and given him such great tributes, because he deserves it. He has a heart of gold and just wonderful.
And you've been listening to Wayne Gretzky eulogizing his father. And by the way, though he suffered tremendous memory loss due to that brain aneurysm, the father did remember many accounts of his own personal faith. And we have a couple of quotes from you. In our family, Walter once said, we're all Christians and we all help each other. It's do unto others as you would like done unto yourself. Walter also said in 2013 that one morning during his rehabilitation, he woke up and couldn't stop singing All of Amazing Grace. And that would be all the verses. It drove my therapist nuts, he said. For my sister and three brothers, Dad was our team captain, Wayne said. He guided, protected, and led our family every day, every step of the way. And by the way, we would love to hear your stories about your father, your mother. And we love eulogies. I mean, not that we love that there's a death, but there inevitably is for all of us. And the eulogy is a summary of a life written by people closest to the person that's departed. And so if you have a great eulogy in mind from a family member or someone else, our favorite here on this show, and I think there are two, Sven Nader, a player who had played for John Wooden, wrote a poem for Coach. Sven was a poet, a great ball player, but a poet. And it was spectacular. And then my favorite, my personal favorite, was Jack Nicklaus eulogizing Arnold Palmer and telling the world what made Arnold special. So if you have those stories, eulogies, and if you have a recording, well, be still my heart. Send it our way. Send it to OurAmericanStories.com. Wayne Gretzky eulogizes his father. And one can tell there was great love there. And when you have a father's love and a mother's love, you're privileged. And when you don't, well, enough said. Wayne Gretzky's eulogy of his father here on Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and our next story, well, we love this kind of story. It comes to us from the Toy and Action Figure Museum in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma. That's right, the Toy and Action Figure Museum. Its founder, Kevin Stark, says it's the first museum to be entirely dedicated to action figures. Take it away, Kevin.
My name is Kevin Stark. I am the curator and executive director of the Toy and Action Figure Museum and also the founder of the museum. And I got started, gosh, I started collecting toys a long time ago, back in 1986. The girlfriend I had at the time drugged me to an antique flea market. And I didn't really want to go spend the afternoon looking at antiques, but they had all these cool toys and they were cheap. And so I came out with an armload of toys. And I said, wow, that was fun. When are we going back? She said, well, it happens every month. And I was like, oh, cool. So I started collecting toys and I amassed this huge collection. But even as a kid, I had convinced my parents to let me clean out our basement so that that could be my private play area. And I shared a room with two brothers. So when my brothers found out that my parents thought that was a great idea, you know, they were a little upset with me over it, but my dad said, hey, he came up with the idea and he cleaned it up, so, you know, get lost. And I had gotten a job when I was like 10 years old in order for me to be able to go and buy my own toys. So I actually been collecting, you know, really since I was 10. But I've just always been attracted to toys, always enjoyed them and liked them. And then when I'm, you know, when it became my business to actually design them, all the better. In 1990, I got a call to design toys. It was actually a guy I went to school with, and he calls and says, how would you like to design toys for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? And I was like, you wouldn't believe what I'm sitting around right now. So I'd already been collecting for 4 or 5 years. he didn't know I was a collector, you know. I didn't know he was a designer, and so we just got together, and he said, can you be in L.A. on Monday morning at 9 a.m. for a flight to L.A.? And I was like, you bet I can. He had been working for small toy companies, and every time the toy companies got bought out, he lost his job. So he decided to start his own company that would do design work, but mostly write copy for the action figures and toys and create the accessories that go in them. And that's a lot of what we did. We would create sewer maps for the turtles, a lot of the extra things, you know, that went in with the toys. We worked for a lot of different toy companies that don't have an in-house design team. Big, huge companies like Mattel and Hasbro and Kenner. And so a company would come to us and say, we need this designed, or we need, like in the case of Toon Sylvania that we did for Spielberg and Toy Island, was like, we need you to design this line based on a cartoon series. And so that's what we did. We would look at the characters and come up with different ways that they could make toys. Everything from plush toys to wind-ups to action figures to play sets. And of course, we would come up with it. You then had to send the drawings over to the company. They would say yay or nay, or they'd make changes here and there. A lot of times we didn't have a lot of time to do it. The deadlines a lot of times were really quick and really short. One toy line in particular, the Mummy, we did for the Universal Studios movie. We had, I think, 2 weeks to design and get some sculpts done before the New York Toy Fair. They kind of went for a long time, no, we're not going to do toys, not going to do toys. And then 2 or 3 weeks before, they said, oh, we're going to do toys. Can you guys knock this out? And so we were working 24 hours a day, taking like little cat naps on my couch in my office and, you know, getting up and doing more drawing. So sometimes it's very fast work, and other times you have lots of time. So, you know, it just varied with the project. I point out to people that come here, there are a lot of doll museums and there are a lot of toy museums, but we are really basically an action figure museum. Our focus is the design and sculpting and art of action figures. So even though we have toys too, most of them relate somehow to action figures, you know, in the way of play sets or vehicles or things like that. So that's what makes us different. And we have over 13,000 action figures in the collection. Most of the collection, 90% of what you see in the museum, is from my private collection. But we do get some things donated. You know, a funny thing is people say, oh, you must do eBay a lot. I never do eBay. I mean, very rarely have I ever picked anything up on eBay. I personally prefer to go out and see the things I'm purchasing. I like to hold it in my hand and say, is this what I want? And purchase it like that. That's just what I prefer, because to me, I like the hunt. So really, I go on what I call toy safari. We got a call from a lady in Arkansas one time, and I didn't talk to her, but one of our board members did. And so he calls me up and he says, you want to go on a road trip? And I was like, what are we talking about? Well, this lady said she had this toy collection she just wanted to donate to the museum. And I said, well, what are we talking about? He said, well, he didn't really know. He said he tried to get her to send pictures, and she didn't really know how to do that on her phone. So she only sent like 3 or 4 pictures that were of these little tiny figures on shelves, you know. So we just hop in my Toyota 4Runner and drive all the way to Arkansas. Well, she had so much stuff that we piled it all in my car, drove back to Paul's Valley, Oklahoma, rented a huge U-Haul truck, and went back, still filled that up and my car again, because we had no idea what we were getting into. It was her husband's collection, and he had passed away and wanted the stuff donated to the museum. And we were like, are you sure you want to do this? Because, you know, we told her she could sell this stuff on eBay or whatever. And she said, no. She said, I'm actually a very minimalist person. I just want all this stuff out of here. And it was funny because the whole house was packed with toys. And she here was telling me she liked to live very, you know, Spartanly. My wife and I went to a garage sale one time here in Paul's Valley, and the family, it was just, you know, the couple, they had a daughter, and we were mostly going to the garage sale for my wife. You know, she was checking stuff out. Well, they had all these cool boy toys. I'm talking about great stuff that was worth a lot of money. And I was just putting everything in my arms, trying to, you know, pick it all up. And my wife was clear across the way visiting with somebody. And I was like, come here, you know. I said, we need to get this stuff. Well, it turned out that the father always wanted a little boy, and he got a little girl. So he was just buying her boy toys too, you know. And I think because he liked them. So I just picked up a lot of really great stuff for next to nothing for garage sale prices, and was very happy to get them, and they're all in the museum right now. Some of my favorite exhibits in the museum deal with my favorite character, which is Batman. In fact, we have a whole Bat Cave devoted to just Batman. So there are a lot of figures there. And we created a World War II display, which we had both the European campaign and the Pacific campaign all done in 12-inch tall action figures. But we built buildings and everything in order to create a diorama of these action figures and recreated the World War II scenes. Well, the older generation of people who would come in here, they loved that because they could relate to that. And a lot of old World War II veterans. And in fact, we had one guy come in who, these figures we used are not G.I. Joes specifically, some of them are from other companies, that are very much accurate figures from World War II. Anyway, this one figure has a shoulder patch on it, which was a paratrooper outfit, paratrooper unit. Well, that guy, that was his unit, okay? He couldn't believe that we had an action figure of his unit in World War II. He was just blown away, and we had a great time talking about it. Most everyone finds something that they can relate to and that they're amazed at. You know, we have people who come in and think, you know, why do I want to be in here? I'm only here because my husband's here or whatever. And then they see stuff they had as a kid. And really, we're less about toys and more about nostalgia, more about your childhood. People come in here, they almost always leave happy, you know. So that's always a great thing.
And you've been listening to Kevin Stark, and he is the founder of the Toy and Action Figure Museum in Paul's Valley, Oklahoma. His story, the story of a museum of a man's making, here on Our American Story.